Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Yeah, you can laugh. I'm the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'd say it to your face, not say it to you now.
I'll come down to Anfield and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
You see, I tried to warn you. This is what happens when I let somebody else, in particular Richie Sadler, sit in the presenter's chair for the day. Welcome to Monday Second Captain's Football Podcast. Hi, Murph and Ken.
We're still on this one, are we?
Yeah. You're still on this?
No, just this obsession with Richie's.
Oh, well, no, it's not my obsession now, Murph.
See, it doesn't even seem like an obsession to you. That's how warped
it's weird that the people who are obsessed about things don't realise that they're obsessed with that thing.
Unusual so far. On the first ever episode of The Player's Chair last week, part of the new Second Captain's World Service, Richie sat down with Sean Dyche, manager of Burnley. What followed was admittedly a searing insight into Dyche's methods. Great interview. Dyche talking about how he gets the best out of... Well, he didn't say limited group of players. I'm putting words in his mouth there, but imbuing them with
Bloody great bunch of lads.
Good football lads, yeah. Imbuing them with old-fashioned values like pride, passion, fighting spirit, all those qualities that have disappeared from so many Premier League footballers, Ken, apparently. Very next game, anyway. Burnley, welcome. Non-league, Lincoln City to Turf Moor. And look, it's not me saying anything about this. I'm going to hand you over to Tariq Amir, one of the many people who tweeted something along these lines. Is it too early to attribute Burnley's fate to the curse of the player's chair? Well, no, Tariq. I would say that's just about right. How else to explain? I mean, there's no way it was just a case of an understrength Burnley team being totally unmotivated by the thoughts of playing a non-league team when they're used to going out against Man United and Liverpool on a weekly basis. No. It's the curse, Murph, of the player's chair.
Are you actually trying to turn people off appearing on Richie Sadler's The Player's Chair?
Is that what you're doing? You've got to be wary of what comes up next. Maybe just do it in the off-season. You haven't got a game the following week. The curse is only ever going to last a couple of weeks. So if you do it in the summer, there'll be a lot of interviews in the summer. And then
we've done a lot of tests on the player's chair curse. And the effects wear off after a number of weeks. So just bear that in mind.
I must say I enjoyed the Joey Barton, big Matt Reed battle, Ken.
Joey Barton is one of those funny players. He's actually smaller than you think he is.
But particularly when he's getting into it with a guy about a foot taller than him.
Matt Reed was...
Started playing at the top level. Only started playing professionally at 28 years of age or something like that.
Yeah. The BBC website, I think, described him as a domineering presence.
Yeah. You don't miss him. You wouldn't miss him out in the field anyway.
And, Joey Barton was taunted and mocked by everybody, the internet, for his behaviour, which appeared to... Okay, so first of all, he stamped on the foot of Matt Reed or put his heel studs into Matt Reed's foot. Then he sort of scuttled around Matt Reed and fell to the ground as though he had been felled by a haymaker. The referee didn't fall for it. Mm-hmm. And then in a subsequent scuffle, Joey Barton was seen to sort of put his hand into someone's face. Not with any great violence, but,
you don't raise a hand in football.
Yeah, sometimes you do, but you're not supposed to. So People saying, oh, what a disgrace, Joey Barton. He did, however, also get a massive elbow to the head from Matt Reed. Did you see
that?
I wouldn't have actually seen this if Joey Barton, because I didn't watch the full game, although I had, there was a friend of mine texting me saying, you've got to turn on this game. This is what English First Division football was like back in the 80s. This is it. Like, we're seeing a kind of, this is like Jurassic Park out on this in Turf Moor. But yeah, I wouldn't have actually seen this incident if Joey Barton hadn't tweeted it himself in his own defense. And it was the most credible of the things that he tweeted to defend himself, because he tweeted a few things. He claimed, wasn't trying to get the big man sent off. This is Joey Barton there, of Matt Reed.
Yeah.
Capitalizes big man. It was my job to front screen and disrupt him. Was trying to get back in front of him. Tried to duck under his arm and he moved it back and hit me on the head. Contact is part of the game. No problem with that. Unlike their player saying he was kicked on the floor, and also the one who jumped and held his face as if he'd been struck. But that wouldn't make a good story, would it? Fair play to Lincoln. They were well organised, and that's cup football. Good luck in the next round. So he was kind of trying to be magnanimous in the last week, but wasn't really that magnanimous with his other tweets. I do have to say, though, he did take a hell of... The elbow was by far the worst thing out of all the things that I saw in terms of violence.
I'm just looking at that now, yeah. That was this elbow in particular. Not to be confused with the previous incident you mentioned after the stamp. After the stamp, Reed went to remonstrate with the referee. As he took his put his arms out to remonstrate, Barton managed to run into one of the arms and jump to the ground. What you're talking about was in open play, Barton jumping up for a header, actually standing there about to jump for a header, and big Matt Reed comes in and clocks him.
Yeah, yeah, properly.
I don't know why I'm laughing.
I don't know why. I suppose just because you're uncomfortable. You're a little uncomfortable with this material, and it's nervous laughter. That's what's happening.
Fair to say anybody could have managed those guys?
No, of course not.
About 12. Everyone in the city knew about it, but no one had seen him.
Look how happy I was. What the fuck happened? No, really. What happened?
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuaders of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Curses aside, it was a great start to the second Captain's World Service last week to have Sean Dyche in the player's chair, one of the top young managers in English football at a time when English football is screaming out for top young managers. Interestingly, though, Dyche sounded really, really wary of the idea of going after the top job right now.
The pressure on your family, if that job offer ever did come, that will never change. The England job comes with certain baggage. Like, what age will your kids have to be, or what will your personal life have to look like for you to go, okay, now I'm ready to deal with that bit?
Well, I think personally, and I'm a big family man, as you well know, then I think for a 14-year-old and 11-year-old to take that on now is too young. Simple as that.
What's the right
later
age?
On it? Well, I don't think there is a right age, but what I'd say, old enough to understand the complexities of it. Because let's face it, how many good stories do you know about the England manager?
Exactly, as he shakes his head.
Yeah, exactly. So the chances are it's not going to be that much good news unless you win a major tournament. Well, people haven't been winning major tournaments, and it doesn't mean you don't want to go at it, and doesn't mean you haven't got a thirst to do it somewhere down the line, by the way. I must make that clear, and take the heat, because I've got no problem with that. But not at a stage in my family's life. They're not ready to deal with that. My son takes heat at school because I'm Burnley manager. Do you know what I mean? You know, because Burnley's not the trendy, it's not Arsenal, it's not Chelsea. So, you know, I'm not going to put that on their lives for starters. But I must make it clear, this is imbalanced, by the way, because, you know, the thing is with interviews like this, you know, someone will lift this and then make a big drama out of this. I'm just trying to speak honestly, open about it, you know. There's no drama to it.
Yes, that's right. Sean Dyche's son goes to school, presumably in Burnley or somewhere in the greater Burnley region, and gets stick from his classmates because his dad is the Burnley manager. Jeez, it's all about the top four these days, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Even there is no defined top four anymore, I don't think, but... That's the way it is for poor Sean Dyche's kids, and he's worried. I know, Ken, you're a little dubious. You think it might be a bit different if the FA came to Sean Dyche's door tomorrow, knocked in and said, would you like the job?
He would definitely accept the job. Maybe some of those kids are, you know, Blackburn fans. Sean Dyche was certainly giving thanks for Zlatan over the weekend. Things could have been worse. after going out to Lincoln City. But thank you, Zlatan.
If you're into hearing that entire interview, as well as all six shows we put out last week, and a minimum of six shows a week from now on, just do what so many others have been doing and become a member of the Second Captain's World Service. So membership costs €5 a month plus VAT, depending on where in the world you're living. And as well as the daily podcasts, you get a Second Captain's induction pack, members only events, priority notice to all live events that we do, Second Captain's badge, and a once in a lifetime Kennerly doodle. His Devon toner is a thing of beauty. Mm. There's any denying that.
It neck may have been slightly lengthened just for illustrative purposes, mm-hmm. but either way, a stunning likeness.
You can do all that on secondcaptains.com, but be warned, spending all this time with Second Captains in your ears can have a detrimental?
Detrimental.
That could be a word. No, it's not. A detrimental effect on your relationships, as Dave Long has discovered. Dave tweeted, this is in inverted commas, why are you constantly wearing headphones around the house? Asks fiance. Hashtag World Service. If you prefer to maintain harmony in your home and aren't interested in signing up, that's no problem. You'll continue to get both of our Monday podcasts, whatever way you're listening to this one. That's one football pod and one non-football. For the daily shows, please sign up. Away from Turf Moor, Millwall knocked Leicester out at the new Den. That's their home that looked like it was going to be demolished until the club supporters stepped in with the help of The Guardian's Barney Roney, who's done some great reporting on this story. We're going to talk to Barney in a little while. And poor old Barcelona very nearly got humiliated for the second time in a few days. Dermot Corrigan on that one, all after the report on sport.
So, the FA Cup continues tonight. It's Sutton against Arsenal. It continues this wonderful theme of the real men of lower division and non-league football against, pampered and cosseted Premier League elites. And what better example of that culture could there be than Arsenal Football Club, who go to Sutton? And I mean, there are various spine-chilling details of the
horrors that await.
Just the grit that awaits. It's the real world at Sutton. I mean, I've been in Sutton. It's an extremely normal, suburban area of London, I guess. I don't know if it's technically counted as London, but, it's half an hour on the train from Victoria. It's got the same shops on the high street as anywhere else. But, according to all the build-up to Arsenal, or Sutton against Arsenal, it's a completely different world. It's like... I mean, there's this thing, I was reading about it the other day. Some guy on Reddit had written a post. This is years ago now, but I was only reading about it the other day. Had written a post. Hey guys, what would happen if a unit of US Marines was transported back in time to ancient Rome? Would they have been able to conquered the Roman Empire? Anyway, he wrote this, and it blew up so big that immediately a movie studio was in touch saying, oh, can we buy the movie rights to this idea? So I think there is a movie coming out about this, but before the movie ever actually, before any of us get to see the movie, we will get to see Arsenal against Sutton, which is essentially the same type of setup. Alexis Sanchez standing in the dressing room, probably about to burst into tears. I've never seen anything like this. My God, that ice, that bath. Is it, what is that thing? It's, that's the communal bath. No, the boiler doesn't work. The Sutton groundsman says, Tranmere Rovers used it as an ice bath. So maybe the Arsenal players will be queuing up to jump into that one, because they have to wait, because there's only four working showers. So unless they want to share the space under the shower, they're going to have to queue up.
Yeah.
This is the gauntlet that Arsenal have to run, and also there's a 3G pitch
that could be even more problematic than the robust approach of Sutton.
According to Sutton, there's no problem with this 3G pitch because everybody uses them. Everyone's got them in their training grounds and whatnot.
Yeah. Different from being used to playing an 11-a-side match on it every week, I would have thought.
Arsene Wenger certainly sees quite a few problems with it. he says, it's not the same because it's a dry pitch, and I've heard that Sutton have a wet pitch. So the dry pitch Frank refers to is the one at London Colney, where Arsenal train. They water before the game, so it'll be much quicker. It means the weight on the joints is stronger. You kind of glide. You have to block every time, so it makes football a bit different because the ball comes to you and somebody accelerates and doesn't slow down like in a normal game, so you have to get used to the difference in speed. That's Arsene Wenger. Just making sure that nobody on his team is unduly worried about the challenges.
And I suppose you could argue against that on a normal grass pitch when it's been raining, the ball zips around, the movements are different than when you're just walking around, you're just playing on a perfectly bone dry pitch. So, you know, maybe you're just going to have to deal with that.
Well, Arsenal like that. I mean, they'd water that pitch before every game, get that ball zipping along. But I mean, you know, then once they get out onto that pitch, you know, once they get out of the dressing room environment and out onto the pitch, they then face the men of Sutton United.
Are these guys all 6'6"? They sound like monsters.
It's not so much the height as the girth which will intimidate the whippet-like frames of these Arsenal footballers.
11 big Matt Reeds.
Well, Nicky Bailey told The Sun on Sunday that... he attributes his success in football to the diet. He says, my diet has got me to where I am today. I am not the best eater. He said, I don't think I've ever had a salad in my life or a vegetable. It's always worked for me. My pre-match meal is always a McDonald's.
Sorry, who's this guy? What's his name?
Nicky Bailey.
Nicky Bailey is one of the great PR men I've come across in football in the last 5 years. Talk about giving a journalist what he wants to hear.
This guy understands. This guy gets the FA Cup.
Yeah.
He says, my pre-match meal is always a McDonald's. 9 nuggets. When I was younger, my mum used to try and make me eat the green stuff, but I used to sick it up.
Jesus.
It's all about rattling their players, Bailey continued.
What, eating the McDonald's?
No, he'll have...
Oh, he's moved on from the McDonald's.
If anyone tries to get past me, then they're coming down. So long as it's done in the right way, said Bailey. So, best of luck to Arsenal with all that. I mean, obviously they should win pretty easily. I mean, they are, after all, playing against a team, including players who claim that they've just eaten 9 chicken McNuggets before the game.
And have never eaten a vegetable in his life.
And if anything Arsene Wenger believes in, you know, if there's any truth to any of the system of beliefs that he's developed in his near 70 years on Earth, that should be a big disadvantage to Sutton.
Vegetables are good.
I'm going to say...
one of the cornerstones of Arsene Wenger's managerial philosophy.
What's this guy's name again?
Nicky Bailey.
I'm going to say Nicky Bailey's eaten a vegetable in the past. If he's so into McDonald's, right... surely he's gotten the odd cheeseburger. You get a cheeseburger at McDonald's, you're getting a gherkin in.
My pre-match meal is always a McDonald's. I don't believe it.
Well, they're McNuggets. In fairness, he did say that it was 9 chicken McNuggets.
I suppose, yeah, if you go to McDonald's, you tend to get the same thing every time. So maybe he's never had a burger in there. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it could be. I suppose people do. Yeah, usually you go through a phase of experimentation. I mean, when you try some of the other things.
Not like a McChicken sandwich or anything that crazy.
Have you ever had a McChicken sandwich, Owen?
Oh, yeah.
You have?
Bloody nice, Owen.
And you? Yeah.
I'm a fan, Ken. I'm an acolyte of the McChicken sandwich.
You see a lot of fast food, Ken. I went to McDonald's often enough in certain years of my life that I could justify branching out into the McChicken sandwich.
Listen, I'll be back tomorrow. You know, if this doesn't work out, I'll be back tomorrow.
Tomorrow, I wish it was that long.
But obviously, we had spoken a lot in recent times about Arsene Wenger and his situation there. We got an email, actually, from listener Con Callan, who was at the Emirates.
Editor at secondcaptains.com if you want to email in.
He was at the Emirates and he ran into, I don't know if it'd be too much to say, a friend of the show. Maybe not after this.
I am here with my man Troops.
We're fat, blood. We're fat, fam. Big up all the Irish men in me. I got love for you lot. A lot of love for you lot, man. But we're fat still.
Yeah, he's... that was
I am here with my man Troops.
Troops. Troops only too delighted to... to say hello to his Irish
God,
fans.
It's amazing. You know, he still has time for his fans. It's just...
I love it. But humble. He still does. And this is despite, I don't know if you saw over the weekend, but the long-awaited, I mean, the breathlessly anticipated showdown interview between Gary Neville and the Arsenal Fan TV boys.
Ooh, no, how'd it go?
was disappointingly boring, Owen. I have to level with you here. I did have high hopes for this, but it turned out to be, it was like Neville has invited them evidently to the MNF studio. They're in the Sky studios. They're kind of sitting around Robbie, the Arsenal Fan TV presenter, the four personalities, four of the more well-known fans, Troops, DT, Claude, and Mo, and then on the other side, Gary Neville. And Neville is there. He adopted a sort of monumental pose in his chair, with his, you know, sitting sort of back. Imagine the Lincoln Memorial. That was the pose that Gary Neville adopted, with his hands, both hands resting on his thighs, as he surveyed. He cast a cold eye over the Arsenal Fan TV boys. And what happened then was about 35 minutes of essentially circular conversation, in which they accused him of not, or they demanded to know why they didn't get enough respect from him. And he said, I do respect you, but I disagree with you. And a lot of it had to do with his disrespectful tone when he said that the Arsenal fan was an idiot for bringing the banner. And Neville said, look, where I come from, idiot's not really offensive. You have to go some further way up the ladder of insult in order to get a reaction. But you know, it was kind of like, oh, we're not getting. It seemed like you are actually sitting in the Sky studio now, talking to Gary Neville, who's probably the best known pundit on television in the country at this time. You know, there's no point in spending all that time sort of wanting to know why you're not taken seriously by people like Gary Neville, who's literally sitting in front of you. You know what I mean? So yeah, from that point of view, it was. It wasn't all that helpful. I mean, you could see that there was definitely. It might have been a bit different if the Arsenal Fan TV guys had adopted more of their persona that they have when they're actually angry after a defeat.
It's turning blood.
Yeah,
but the issue there is that they weren't angry after a defeat, and they were also in the wrong physical space. That meeting had to take place outside the Emirates after a defeat. Otherwise, what's the point? What's the point of those guys? Blood. What's the point to him if he's not raging after a defeat?
Do you think that's necessarily true? I mean, he's
no. But my point being that if you're walking into Gary Neville's studio, Gary Neville's home, you're going to be more polite.
You think Neville might have nubbled him somewhat by the choice of venue
and possibly killed him with a bit of kindness. I don't know how kind he was.
I think that might have been the case. I think it might have been the case. I mean, it's something that was done by Jose Mourinho, wasn't it? That was one of his first things that he did when he arrived at Manchester United. Remember that? Almost his first act was to defang the most potent critic of the previous two regimes.
You got the job on a technicality.
Yeah.
Defanged, was he, by Mourinho?
Well, he was brought in by Jose Mourinho. I think this was before Manchester United had played any games when Mourinho was the manager. But he knows that football isn't all about what happens on the field. Sometimes what happens off the field is also important. So one of the first things he did was bring in Andy Tate. It was a little bit like a cat going to the vet. you know, the cat, maybe a temperamental young tomcat, full of energy, comes into the vet, gets tickled on the belly, sort of a numbing injection, and a few months later, the cat is noticeably more sluggish, more rounded in physical appearance, and isn't getting half as many views on YouTube. Not a fraction as many views. Jose Mourinho conducted a Q&A with Andy, which took the form of a friendly quiz. Do we have a bit of audio from that? Let's hear a bit.
It's time starts now.
Oh, God.
You've just parked up at Cannington, and one of the lads walks past. What do you say?
All right, mate.
Correct. What is the pub in Corrie called?
The Rover's Return.
Correct. And what beer do they serve?
Newton and Ridley.
Sorted. What is your favourite member? I'll take that.
Jason.
Mine too. Correct. What do we call food in Manchester?
Scran.
Correct. Finish this sentence. Meat pie, chips, peas and...
gravy.
I would also have accepted curry sauce.
Very professional there, so Mr. Tate.
I think on that video there's about 100,000 views. I mean, when you compare it to the you got the job on a technicality from a legend who recommended you, it's more in the region of 2.5 million. And obviously was used as the base for thousands and thousands of other clips and vines and whatnot. I guess has been viewed a billion times. You know, it's definitely the Gangnam style of fan TV thing. But there hasn't been anything like that since. And I just wonder if Jose, if that was one of the smarter things he's done.
Could be Wenger's next step to get a couple of the boys in and do a quiz like that.
Yeah, he arguably should have done it before.
I think maybe it's gone a little too far now.
It may have. But what's just speaking of Mourinho, obviously his team had a good comeback win against Blackburn Rovers, a great link up between Pogba and Ibrahimovic. Ibrahimovic is phenomenal. I mean, Ibrahimovic is now the top scorer at Manchester United for the last two seasons. You know, since the beginning of last season, he's obviously only been there, you know, half of a season or a little over half a season. 24 goals. So he's on track to score like 30 goals as a 35-year-old.
A bit more than that, I'd say, is it?
Well, you know, I mean, it's, you're assuming nothing happens to him injury-wise. You know, he's going well. I mean, he's on target, certainly, to score more than 30 goals, which is a phenomenal return. Absolutely phenomenal. I mean, he signed on a free transfer. Okay, he's very far from a free transfer. He's a very expensive. He's a very expensive player. But the idea of a 34, 35-year-old arriving in a free transfer scoring 30 goals is, you can't really expect that. Ibrahimovic has got one fewer goal than Lionel Messi since the start of last season and more goals than Ronaldo. You know, 75 for Messi. He scored two last night. Zlatan has got 74. Ronaldo has got 72 since the beginning of last season. It's absolutely incredible. When you consider his age is just... He's a massive outlier. You know, I can't think of anything.
And as... one of the Man United players over the weekend, I think it was Chris Smalling, was also marvelling at how much he plays. Yeah. You know, he was saying, like, this guy's played more for us than almost anybody else, but his age is not an issue and let's just sign him up for another year.
I mean, age is clearly not not everybody ages at the same rate. I think it's fair to say, you know, some people are able to keep it going a bit longer than others. Zlatan is obviously in that category. Although you would have thought, given his immense size, that... you know, it's not easy for a guy that size to stay as fit as he is. You know, it's just like, I have no idea how he's able to do it. But he is, he bailed Manchester United out of it again.
Nice goal, too.
Beautiful goal. And there's a great photograph of it. I don't know if you've seen where it's a photograph from kind of almost behind the goal. So it's facing, you can see the goalkeeper in the foreground and Zlatan behind. And Zlatan is grinning ear to ear because he can see the ball is going in. he's already just grinning as he runs away. But obviously, Jose Mourinho, as you heard in the quiz answers with Andy Tate, he understands English culture. And he was making the point that some of these foreign managers don't. You've got managers who don't really get it, sure. He says, he talked about some of his own experiences. He said, he talked about playing against Newcastle with Chelsea in his first season. I threw it away. I gambled too much, he said, Chelsea's FA Cup defeat to Newcastle in his first season. I focused too much on Barcelona and Liverpool. They were playing Barcelona in the Champions League. Remember they beat them 4-2, was it, at Stamford Bridge? And Liverpool, who they were playing, they beat Liverpool in the League Cup final around the same time. So I don't throw it away now. If I lose, I lose because the opponent was better or because we didn't play well. He says, maybe we don't have as many English managers with that culture as we should. Maybe we foreign managers, not everybody studies and understands the culture of the country. In my case, I had immediately, in my first time, that situation with the match at Newcastle. For me, it was a lesson. Some of these guys never learn, though. I wonder, will Pep Guardiola learn? He drew 0-0 against Huddersfield. Manchester City drew 0-0 against Huddersfield. Of course, Manchester City had, you know, noticeably weakened team.
I'm so happy, believe me.
He was asked about the he was asked about this decision to you know, say, make 8 changes or whatever. My friend, I take the decisions. You analyze my decisions. In other words, I don't analyze my own decisions. You'd expect me to do your job for you as well, Mr. Reporter, sir. You have to take a decision before the game. It's the best solution. It was what I did. If you don't agree, you can write it. What I hear in the last 10 days. He went on to talk about something we've been talking about a lot. What I hear in the last 10 days about how people, ex-players and journalists, treat Arsene Wenger is unacceptable. Our job in this moment doesn't have any respect for any position. It's not respectable what happened. That's why we take the decisions. You can say whatever you want. So,
Wenger will like that, won't he? Wenger will appreciate that the much younger, more fashionable super manager has, without prompting, come out and defended Arsene Wenger's honour.
I think so. Although, you know, plenty of people do have been defending Arsene Wenger's honour. I mean, we mentioned Gary Neville. He spent a lot of the interview, the 36 minutes of it or whatever, repeating over and over again what a great manager Arsene Wenger was. You know what I mean? He definitely went out to bat for him. You hear it from a lot of people. I mean, Arsene Wenger just needs to win some games. It's just that's just the way it works.
Win some games starting against the monster Gladiators at Sutton tonight. That's it for Kennedy's Report on Sport. Baby,
I've lost the First Minister's name.
Kieran Murphy, our second captain, and John Henderson, former Kilkenny and Wicklow hurler. Thank you both indeed for that. That's our lot for today. Just one headline. The British Prime Minister, Theresa May, is to meet the Taoiseach Enda Kenny in London tomorrow. This morning she's at Stormont meeting Martin McGuinness and also Theresa...
Sorry, I've lost the First Minister's name.
Arlene Foster.
Arlene Foster, thank you for that.
All right, one of the big results of the weekend was Millwall knocking Leicester out at the New Den, a stadium that looked as though it was going to be demolished up until fairly recently. It hasn't been, and things are looking up for Millwall, thanks in large part to the work of our next guest, the Guardian's Barney Roney. Barney, you've been working closely with supporters of the club, and you've been a big part of this. You must have been pleased to see them get a big result like that on the pitch.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing, beating the champions of England, albeit pretty rubbish champions of England, is kind of, you wouldn't be allowed to make it up in the film version of this, would you? And it was an amazing day. It was beautifully sunny. The Den was full. And it was just a really nice day in the sun for everyone there. And at the end of a really horrible, stressful period as well, like you say.
Yeah, stressful period. Barney, can you get yourself let us know how you got yourself involved in this, how you started reporting this story? What came to your attention?
Well, I'm not exactly a Millwall fan, but I'm a local person. I've lived in the borough for my whole life, and this had been bubbling away at the edge of things. You kept hearing about it and thinking, oh no, someone will stop that. That won't happen. That's too ridiculous. It can't possibly happen. You kept hearing about the plans of the council to seize the land around the Den where the Millwall Community Trust is, which is a fantastic thing. It's an incredibly, well, it's a very rundown area. It needs all the help it can get, and Millwall do great things in the community. And you kept hearing this was happening and thinking, no, that just can't be right. So I started to look into it when it just nobody carried on doing the thing. It just kept going through. And the first thing that really rang a bell with me was having a proper look at who was involved in this and discovering at that point that the company that stood to benefit from this deal had actually been originally set up by the previous Labour mayor of Lewisham, which I don't know about you, but it strikes me as a slightly odd one. And it all kicked on from there, really.
What did this deal look like, you know, on the surface? I mean, what were they presenting it as? What were they trying to sell it as?
Well, I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, nobody disputes that the area could do with a lick of paint and a tidy up. You know, it's a light industrial area, half a mile from the Shard. There's just too much money around for that to be allowed to stay like that. Money will not let it happen. So this was presented as a housing deal. You know, build houses, that sounds good. And here's a developer that seems somehow to own lots of land in the area, old warehouses and plots of land, and just presented as a good deal for everyone. We'll get a housing zone grant. It's only when they started talking about compulsory purchasing land and evicting local residents, which really has to be in the public interest, that you start to think, well, hang on, that doesn't quite sound right. Who's that benefiting exactly? And I mean, it's basically like the worst episode of The Wire you've ever seen. You kind of follow the money, and rather than sort of glamorous American people, it's a bunch of absolutely mediocre local politicians sort of cooking up some kind of deal. And thankfully, we've managed to chuck something in the spokes.
A few months ago, you wrote, for a start, the plans to create a, quote, new community, unquote, overlook the fact that Bermondsey already has a community, one that has been flourishing quietly with help from Millwall themselves. What kind of stuff were you talking about there? How were Millwall helping the local community?
Well, I mean, that's basically the nail on the head, isn't it? Who do we want to live in our cities is the point. Something like Millwall, they've been in that area of London for, you know, over 100 years and about 120 years in all. At times, it's been the most abandoned place imaginable. I mean, Millwall's problems in the 70s and 80s, I mean, everybody knows about that. It was a pretty grim place. I went there myself. A lot of that, you know, these are societal problems. I mean, it was a massively abandoned bit of London. There is a really interesting history of all that to be written. But the club did hold the place together. It was the centre of that place. People love that club. They, you know, it really is massively valued. It's utterly bound up in that community. I can't think of a small English club with a stronger identity than Millwall. It kind of sums up that idea of people still being allowed to live in cities, even though they're not working in the financial industries and they're just simply trying to sort of exist in the place where their families have been. So, I mean, the club is very much a part of the community in that sense. Also, it does massive work in the community. The community trust is a brilliant thing. They work with kids and ex-offenders and people who just can't have any training, can't get jobs, and they do fantastic things. So the idea that you want to encourage local people to regenerate their local community by basically buggering off and living somewhere else and getting out of everybody's way and letting the bulldozers come in is something that's always bothered me. And you see it happening in every city around the world, and it's something that needs to have checks and balances on it.
I mean, this is a kind of complicated question, I guess, Barney, but I mean, you did mention, okay, it's half a mile from the Shard. London is the richest city in Europe. How did this area become sort of, I don't know if left behind is really the right phrase, but so poor compared to nearby areas of London?
Well, it's always been historically poor. It's kind of landlocked in this bend of the Thames. To get in or out is quite difficult. I still get lost there. It's quite a confusing, weird bit of London. There's no bridge there. There's a couple of tunnels. And it's sort of lost. It was a marshland originally. They had biscuit factories there and tanneries. And it was always this slightly weird, lost part south of the city. Then it got bombed to death by the Luftwaffe. And on the back of that, they built a lot of new housing, what we'd see now as rubbish council blocks. But in that is a lot of social housing. There are people who are on protected tenancies. You know, I mean, this was quite a left-wing idea that people would be allowed to live there, they'd be protected. And I mean, another reason why Bermondsey is still this place that hasn't been washed out and gentrified and turned into crappy flash flats is because it's full of people who were moved into the new council buildings that were built when it was flattened in the war and who are on protected tenancies and who are allowed to live in the city, who are people who work and live around there and somehow can exist without working in financial services, which I happen to think is a good thing.
You talked about, Barney, about how this the trail led to mediocre politicians. What exactly went wrong? How did the plan get sunk eventually?
Well, they've tried to pass this compulsory purchase order. They tried to reconfirm it 3 or 4 times, and each time some pesky fact keeps getting in the way. I mean, at first it was we discovered a sales brochure which showed that one of the developers had been trying to sell their land around Millwall's Ground already, you know, sell it on for a quick deal, which had to be investigated, which kind of delayed it a bit. Some of the Labour councillors there, I mean, it's a one-party state, Lewisham. It's a huge place. It's got its economy, its population the size of Iceland. It's £1 billion economy, but it's a one-party state. It's like a dictatorship. And some of the Labour councillors who are a bit further to the left have been objecting, have been just about stopping it going through. And then it all kind of came to a head when we started really looking into their funding and discovering they've made up all the charity at the heart of it, made up all sorts of strange promises that weren't actually true. You know, I mean, sort of dishonesty about funding from quite reputable charities to help them build their entirely bogus sporting village, which is designed to replace Millwall, which actually is a sporting village. And in the end, it was just a thousand cuts. It just fell to pieces. Even basically quite mendacious politicians were unable to force this through. And they're having their own inquiry now.
Would you say that this is, let's say, an atypically egregious example of an urban regeneration project, that what was happening in Bermondsey was like so out there that these types of things probably don't happen in every other similar borough around or council area around the UK?
I think it's happening everywhere all around the world. And this, the thing about this is all we've done is just turn on the lights and have a look at it. As we know, local newspapers, they're on a shoestring. They can't scrutinise this stuff anymore. So who else is scrutinising it? There are devolved powers everywhere. I think this is happening all around the world. And the one thing we've done is actually look at it. But I think deals like this go through constantly. I mean, what it really reminds me of, I don't know if you ever saw the programme Our Friends in the North, which was about a very similar scheme which happened in Newcastle, where they built the worst council flats you've ever seen on the back of a kind of friends and developers in the council deal. And it ended up being a terrible scandal, and the flats were basically, they got rained on, they're made of cardboard and fell down. And it weirdly reminds me of that. It's the idea that you need to build houses. People have somewhere to live. And then it gets filtered through this local politics where it's all friends, nobody's watching. And I think this is happening all over the world. I think scouring of cities and the forcing out of people, the way money is ultimately key to everything. You must have seen it. Everybody must have seen this wherever they live. But in Bermondsey, like you say, it was so cartoonish and absurd that we actually were able to bring it to light.
Yeah, it's great work you've done, Barney. And we have heard a rumour behind the scenes that there's talk of Barney Roney maybe being nominated for Millwall's Player of the Year. is this true, or have we been misinformed?
Well, I think the great shame of that is the cup run's probably scuppered.
Yeah, there's too many guys banging in goals and so on, yeah.
Gutted about that. It's not good for me, this cup run. So I can't see that happening.
Listen, Barney, great work. And thanks a million for talking to us today. Cheers.
Cheers. See you.
We only touched on the dramatic nature of the win itself. In fact, we barely touched on it. It was a last-minute winner, in case you missed this Millwall-Leicester game over the weekend.
Here's Gregory on the chest. A little run beyond him. Cummings in the area. Cummings for Millwall! Yes! Yes! Millwall score! Cummings with the goal for Millwall! Unbelievable! We are just heading into added on time, and Millwall take the lead! Up from the back line!
And cue pitch invasion from some overexcited home supporters, Ken.
Yeah, there was quite a few supporters on the field after the final whistle went. Police horses clearing the way and three arrests zone. Everybody afterwards, well, certainly everybody on the Millwall side agreed that, look, it was inevitable there was going to be a bit of a pitch invasion. You know, you don't knock out the champions, the third Premier League team they've knocked out on this cup run, and expect the fans not to show their happiness. What's wrong with everybody running onto the pitch in a chaotic manner, running over to where the away fans are and making threatening gestures? What's wrong with that? Well, you know, the game's gone. You know, if fans aren't allowed to do that, then
political
the game is gone.
Political correctness gone mad, Ken, if you ask me.
A tricky old evening for Barcelona last night. Looked for a long time, or for a period of time, as though they're going to be held at home by Leganés, not a big club in Spain, not a powerhouse. I don't know if you noticed, Ken, that there was a screen grab this at one stage. So impressed was I by how clueless the Barcelona, or how freaked out the Barcelona coaching team looked at one point. You can see here, this is...
Yeah, that's Luis Enrique and his psychologist.
Oh, is that a psychologist as opposed to... Okay.
Yeah, the sports psychologist whose job is to... go about with Luis Enrique.
All right, well, you might describe the psychologist's reaction to the goal going in against his team.
He is doing very much an, I don't know, his eyebrows are raised, his lips are sort of pressed together, his hands are, he's almost raising his palms to the sky. Luis Enrique is looking to him as though for guidance, as so often happens, and he's just kind of drawing a bit of a blank.
It's beyond my remit, mate. I don't know why we're 1-1 at home to this team, but you can have a look, Murph, as we introduce our next guest, Dermot Corrigan. They had a few days to digest the result against Paris Saint-Germain, and I don't think too many people, Dermot, are giving Barcelona a chance of clawing that deficit back in the Champions League. Certainly with what happened last night against a tiny club, they did get the win in the end, but only just about. It was so close to Leganés taking a point from the Nou Camp.
Yeah, it was pretty weird, all right. Like, Leganés haven't won since November. They're in awful form. They're as you say, a really small club who just came up for the first time this season, and they look to be headed back down again. So nobody really expected them to get anything, especially after Messi scored so early in the game to put Barca 1-0 up. You thought, okay, Barca aren't going to play great, but they're going to just go through, win 2 or 3-0, and it'll be fine. But even inside the stadium, there was like a weird atmosphere with the half the fans chanting Luis Enrique's name in a kind of a club supported kind of a way, and then the other half booing them and whistling them and telling them to stop. So it's just a weird situation, a weird atmosphere at the game. You know, Leganés equalised, then Messi scored a penalty at the end. But even then, Messi didn't look too happy about it. You know, he had a kind of grim look on his face. He didn't celebrate at the final whistle either. And it's clear that something's just broken inside the club, and it's a big problem for them for sure.
Messi's penalty was quite funny, actually. He sort of strode up, belted the ball in, really kicked through the ball, stood there posturing a little bit by Leo Messi standards. But I think he was in a much less demonstrative manner, say, than Alexis Sanchez at Arsenal. I think maybe he was trying to get a message across there that we shouldn't be resorting to this last-minute penalty to beat these guys.
Yeah, he looked kind of embarrassed about the situation that he was having to do it and to come through and pull them out of it again. It's really hard to know what's going on inside Messi's head. Like, he doesn't talk very much about it. When he does talk, often he just gives kind of bland answers to questions at FIFA events and stuff. But it's pretty clear that he's not so happy with how things are going. I think more than with Luis Enrique, he's just annoyed with the way the club has been run over the last couple of years. That he doesn't have a good relationship at all with the board. His dad doesn't get on with the directors. He feels that they don't really know what they're doing. It seems like he's criticised them in the past, saying that they're just businessmen, that they don't understand football. And I think more than anything, that's that kind of disconnection between the star players who've been there for a good while and the guys who run the club that is the biggest problem.
Yeah, well, we can get into who really is running that club, I guess. But just on the actual team itself, there are a lot of problems in that team. I mean, okay, maybe it's not at full strength, but watching it last night, the fullbacks both look like completely out of place dweebs. Like, they don't have any... There was a moment in that game when Lucas Digne, the left-back, played the ball up the line to Neymar and then stood there. It was in the second half. Stood there sort of looking at him. And Neymar, with the ball at his feet, looked back at him and then, like, swiped his hands through the air as though to say, move, you know, get up. Like, I'm going to give you the ball back, but I need you to be moving. It was kind of... These guys don't know what they're doing out there.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, Barca's bought a lot of players in recent years. Just looking at the thing this morning, like, they spent more than 100 million last summer on a load of players. They spent similarly the summer before, even though they had the transfer ban. And they brought in a lot of these guys, like Dean, like Alex Vidal, even Arda Turan, Paco Alcacer, Andre Gomez, who I guess we could talk about as well, who they just don't look like Barca players. Like, before, you know, when Guardiola was there or when things were winning, they just brought in these kids from the youth system who seemed to know what to do. Like, they knew where to run, at least, or they knew where to position themselves, what to do to put the platform there for Messi or Neymar or whoever to do their thing. But at the moment, there's no structure in the team. They're not sure what they're doing. It doesn't look like Barca anymore. Before, you used to look, okay, these are real Barca players. But at the moment, they just look like anybody else, really, and it's just not working for them.
Has Andre Gomez become the general scapegoat? I mean, he was getting booed by the crowd, which is obviously never a good sign.
Yeah, he seems like a nice enough guy himself, Andre Gomez. He talks, he's very... modest about it and says he's just happy to be there and stuff. But he's clearly not a Barca style midfielder. Like, he's not the most mobile. He's not on the same wavelength as Messi and Iniesta and these guys. And it's clearly playing on him. Like, he knows that he's not really fitting in there, and he knows that he's not doing what he's supposed to do, which means that, like, his confidence seems to be shattered, and he's not sure what to do. And yeah, like, they spent a lot of money on him. He was 35 million, which could go to 70 million if everything works out the way it did in the clause. I was looking at the statement Barca put out last summer when they signed him, which had 15 million extra if he wins multiple Ballon d'Or trophies. Like, it was pretty unlikely to happen at the time, and it's not going to happen now. And it goes back to what I was saying about the board, that the players that they've signed are not the right players. I think the likes of Messi and Iniesta know that they're not getting the help that they should be getting, and that, you know, that's what's happening on the pitch now.
Well, what about then off the pitch? Because you mentioned Messi's relationship with the directors and so on, and he has said contemptuous things about some of them in the past. And based on the decisions that they've been making over the last year or 2 years, he probably has a point there, that these guys aren't necessarily demonstrating the greatest skill or expertise in carrying out their duties. Barcelona, it looks like, are going to have to find a new coach. I mean, I guess, you know, that looks like a 95% likelihood at this point. So they're going to be hiring someone new in the summer. But who makes the decision over who it's going to be? That board of directors doesn't have the authority to appoint a coach that Lionel Messi doesn't like.
Yeah, it's true. Like, there's nobody there really who's a leader at the club. Like, Bartomeu, the president, has no charisma at all. You know, the sporting director, Robert, is an ex-Barca player, but he's not a big name, and it doesn't seem that people take him serious. Even the players, he can say something, the players will come out and contradict him the next week. The last time this kind of happened was when Tardo Martino took over, and he seemed to be at least had the nod from Messi or Messi's family as another Argentinian, a guy from Rosario as well. Does look like Messi is in the driving seat. Like, he's got 14 months or 16 months or whatever is left on his contract. The board need him to sign it, so he looks like he could have the say on who comes in. Maybe they go for another Argentinian. Sampaoli's doing really well at Sevilla. He'd be an interesting guy to get in. But again, it's not a good situation for anybody, really, if they're going to Messi, who's not the most, you know, it's hard to know what Messi really thinks. He's not the most communicative or articulate of guys. So if he has a say over it, it's just not a good situation.
Is Ronald Koeman an outside bet? We're talking about Enrique as though he's gone, but let's talk that way for the time being. Is Koeman a possibility?
Koeman, like, he would be popular with older Barca fans, I guess, because he's involved. Like, he scored that goal that won them their first Champions League. He knows the club inside out. I think he doesn't really get talked up that much in the local press. Like, in the Catalan press, he'd still be seen as an outsider. There's the Athletic Bilbao coach is also in it, Valverde, who's another ex-Barca player, and he's done a really good job at Athletic. He knows the Liga really well. But again, he's not that kind of glamorous, or he doesn't have the charisma that maybe Sampaoli would have, somebody who would lift things and get a positive mood around the club again. It's hard to know, really. Like, Luis Enrique didn't have a great record either when he came in, but in his first season, things went flying under him. He had, you know, he got them running again. He got them intensity up again. It's a difficult decision. And as you said, there isn't anybody really there who can stick their neck out and go, look, I know what I'm doing here. Trust me, I'm going to hire this guy. So if it does start to go wrong really quickly, again, the floodgates just open and they get criticised again.
I mean, I would have to say that the outstanding Spanish coach, well, maybe Basque coach, I don't know how strong he feels about all that, is Unai Emery, who just masterminded their destruction in Paris the other day. What is it the case with Barcelona that unless you've got, you know, as they say, Barcelona DNA, they just aren't going to be that interested in you. They might rather look at someone like Ronald Koeman because, you know, he's done okay jobs at various, you know, at various clubs because he scored a goal for them at Wembley and several other goals besides, rather than a guy like Emery who's got no connection to Barcelona but does appear to be a really, really good manager.
Yeah, like, Koeman's record in Spain at Valencia was pretty awful. He got bombed out of there after all the players gave up on him like over a decade or so ago now. And, you know, he's done okay with Southampton and Everton, but it's not compared to what Unai Emery has done. But I'd say that Barca are a bit like Madrid, that what you do at other clubs doesn't have that much of an influence on what happens when you take over. There's so many big stars there. It's such the atmosphere is so unique, really, about dealing with the media, with the expectations of the fans, with having, you know, the best squads in the world really to deal with. Being able to organise Everton or Paris Saint-Germain even is just a different skill set than what you need to be the Madrid or the Barca coach.
All right, Dermot Cargan, great to talk. Thanks, Emil.
Cheers, guys.
I got a bone to pick. I do like Ken Early's work.
I do like Ken Early's work.
I wouldn't necessarily agree with anything Ken Early says about football. I'm mad,
but I ain't stressed. He writes fluently and thinks cogently.
You mentioned Ken Early, but I wouldn't necessarily
agree with anything Ken Early says about football.
He just thinks I'm an annoying twat.
Did you just describe Barcelona's fullbacks as dweebs?
That was kind of how they seemed to me, yeah. They seemed like they were kind of having a bit of a nightmare. Like, we have ended up here out of our depth horribly. Where we've got these sulky three guys up front who are the best in the world, right? The three most intimidating.
Most annoyingly, yeah.
They are the three most intimidating players in the world to be part of a team that they don't think you're good enough to be on with. And they were just sinking. I mean, Sergio Roberto threw himself to the ground in the build-up to the Leganés goal. I mean, he was trying to win a free kick and he just fell over really weakly, you know, and the Leganés equalised. This was with about 20 minutes to go. So it did look at that point as though Barcelona were going to that was going to cost them more points. And it was just so weak, you know, and so it was so humiliating for him. But you know, the incident with Neymar on the other side that I mentioned with Dermot there, you know, it was kind of like Neymar looking at him going, what are you doing? Do you not understand football? Whereas the guy, Dean, he was there just waiting. He was obviously this kind of passive figure, like unsure of what to do, like afraid to take the initiative. You know, he wasn't sure if he should I make this run? Would it be right? I'll just hold my position. And that's just not really good enough for a club on this sort of level. And I mean, when you see that, for instance, the player they used to have instead of Sergio Roberto, Dani Alves, you know, when you see they've gone from that from that level of player to this, it's really, you know, there's no like Dani Alves is one of these kind of bionic players, almost like he clearly didn't get enough respect. Actually, there were some interesting quotes from him today.
Sorry, you just... I was about to ask that. Was he even slightly underappreciated while he was there?
Well, he was, yeah.
Because there was always this, oh, Dani Alves, yeah, good going forward. And like, as though that's only a small part of the game for a start, even if he wasn't the greatest defensive fullback of all time. His ability to go forward was what prompted a lot of Barcelona's brilliant play.
He played as their right winger, really,
yeah,
and also their right back, because he was a player with the unusual stamina that he could kind of do both jobs. Obviously, Barcelona, a team that spends a lot of time in the front foot. I mean, I think Dani Alves would spend more time in the opposing half than any other player in La Liga. There was some crazy statistic like that. Like, he was the furthest forward Barcelona player, even though he was their right back. And he was fundamental to their whole system of play, particularly Lionel Messi. He was like a mobile wall. Messi could knock a pass off any time and get it back, yeah, in any area of the field. And he doesn't have that now. You know, the right side of their team has kind of collapsed since he's gone. And he's got some quotes now. He says, I'd like to be loved. If they don't want me, I'm leaving. Leaving Barcelona on a free was a big lesson. During my last three seasons, I always heard, Alves is leaving. The managers never said anything to me. When he says managers, he means directors. He says, they were very false and ungrateful. They did not respect me. I was only offered to renew when the FIFA transfer ban came in. That was when I went and signed a deal with a termination clause. Those who run Barcelona today have no idea how to treat their players. So this is a legendary player.
Sorry, was that this week?
That's now. Those quotes are like being reported. Why is that?
Well, just interesting that Dani Alves decided to go public with his concerns this week of all weeks.
Well, he did also
say... He's a regular Nicky Bailey when it comes to playing the PR game.
He did say also that if anyone can come back against Paris, it will be the Barcelona machines. Mm. You know, they've done it too many times for us to say there's no chance.
Yeah.
So he did say that as well. But he has hammered the directors here. And, you know, when you consider what Dermot was saying, you know, about Messi's relationship with them, I'm sure that's the relationship of most of the good players, whereas the more recently arrived players who nobody really respects and who aren't really good enough, maybe they feel differently about it. But you can see a team that's now split in the dressing room and with no clear idea of how they're going to get out of it.
Okay, we've got another show out today. We will certainly have today, Monday afternoon, featuring the GA Footballer of the Year, no less, Lee Keegan, who finally got his hands on an All-Ireland. He won the intermediate title with his club yesterday. So it should be a good chat there. For you World Service members out there, some great stuff on the way for the rest of the week, including tomorrow, Tuesday, 10 years on from England-Ireland at Croke Park, one of the most historic sporting occasions ever to take place in this country. We're talking to two of the players on that day, all-round legend Gerry Flannery and Shane Horgan, who I think scored a try that day. I think that's gone down as part of the folklore of the day. So we'll talk to Shane about all that and Gerry Flannery. If you're not signed up to the World Service just yet, secondcaptains.com is the place to do it. Any problems at all, any technical difficulties signing up, just email members@secondcaptains.com and we'll clear those up, or you can tweet us at secondcaptains. So that email address, if you do happen to encounter a problem, is members@secondcaptains.com. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, Owen.
Thanks, Ciarán.
Thanks, Owen. Ken, you're amazing.
Thanks for listening. You're all amazing.
What phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home. They never go home. They never go home, those boys.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.